for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to another day of Uncommon Sense from the radical middle of the Tom Hartman radio program. 900 days, 12 hours, 53 minutes, 7 seconds, until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily. It's assuming he's not impeached between now and then. Yeah, we're coming up on a milestone. Tomorrow it'll be 899 days. Not bad. Big Pharma's profit margins are the highest of any industry in the world. Now, actually, these statistics are about 2 years old, so maybe oil has surpassed them. I'm suspecting that they have, but they're right up there. Huge, huge profit margins. In 1995, some 25 companies controlled over half of the entire planet's market for pharmaceuticals. By 2000, over half of the entire planet's global market for drugs was controlled by just 15 corporations. Funding on research, for example, for malaria, which kills one child every 30 seconds around the world, is 20 times lower than funding for asthma, for research for drugs on asthma. You know, why? Well, kids in wealthy countries get asthma. Kids in poor countries get malaria. Only 10% of the global health research is devoted to diseases that account for 90% of the world's disease burden. In fact, in 2002, of the top 10 best-selling drugs, the top two were aimed at reducing cholesterol, one tackled high blood pressure, one ulcers, and two were antidepressants. In the U.S. in 2000, the industry spent $92.3 million on 625 lobbyists. That's more than there are members of Congress. In the past decade, the number of sales reps has tripled to 90,000 in the U.S. and 110,000 in Europe. Pharmaceutical companies experimenting on people in third world nations. In 1996, Pfizer gave an unproven drug to Nigerian children and infants suffering from meningitis. Ended up, the drug was shown to be ineffective. A lawsuit against Pfizer claimed some of the children in the trial died, others suffered brain damage, and they didn't realize that they were part of a trial. This was an illegal trial of an unregistered drug, according to the Washington Post. GlaxoSmithKline, Merck, and Wyeth currently conduct 30 to 50% of their experiments outside Western Europe and the United States and plan to boost foreign trials to 67%, according to USA Today. The United States essentially permits pharmaceuticals, as Russell Mokaber writes, to be unregulated monopolies. Patent protection gives the drug companies monopoly control over their products. They don't face competition. They don't face price controls. And they're able to extend the life long beyond the official 20 years of the patents, thanks to a variety of big pharma evergreening tactics, such as just slightly changing the molecules of a drug so that they can say it's a new drug, even though it's the same old drug for all practical purposes. According to the drug companies, the cost of researching and developing a new drug is $800 million. But that's a number that came out of an industry-funded research at Tufts University in Boston where they refused to release the underlying data. So it's simply a matter of faith. In fact, what we do know is that 50% of that is what's called financing cost. In other words, that's the money that they could have made in the stock market had they invested it instead of doing research. It's called opportunity cost of capital. So it actually has nothing to do with the actual research itself, at least half of that so-called cost. So here we have drug companies that are spending enormous amounts of money on advertising and relatively small amounts of money on research comparatively, not to mention the fact that most pharmaceutical research in the United States, or a large chunk of it, is actually paid for by you and I, the taxpayers. In the face of all this, there are folks who think this is just fine. Alex Epstein, he's with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, on the line with us. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Given that rather long-winded indictment of Big Pharma, how can you guys defend them?
Well, yeah, let me say that, I mean, if you want to talk about any of those specific accusations, I'd be happy to, but that obviously I can't respond to 20 specific charges. But I will tell you what I think is the most important consideration here that you didn't mention at all, which is that these companies produce incredible life-saving products that benefit us and extend our lives, improve our lives, literally save our lives in any number of ways. So from AIDS patients to people who have impotence, to people who have severe anxiety or depression, to people who have high blood pressure, there's just, for almost every ailment that exists, we have these drugs and they do incredible things for people. And it is not at all easy to produce them. It takes a lot of scientific ingenuity. It takes this incredible pipeline process. They have to deal with a lot of testing, often over 10 years involved. And it's a process. You say that they have the highest profit margins, and I think that's great. I think it means that they're offering, that's indicative of the great value they're offering.
No, it's indicative of the essential monopoly that they have.
Well, we can address that in a minute. But they, in fact, that is, sorry, I lost my train of thought for 1 second.
You were going down the road about how they've created all these great drugs for us, and isn't that a marvelous thing?
Yeah, oh yeah,
and I'm not disagreeing.
Certainly not true. It's definitely. I mean, in order to make these mega profits, they need to create drugs that are incredibly valuable. There are already hundreds and hundreds of drugs on the market, and they need to offer something that's superior to the existing commercial drugs and then the existing generic drugs that are no longer under patent. And so, and these companies do lose money on any given quarter. And so they take an incredible amount of risk. It's an incredible amount of effort. And we should be grateful that there are these life-saving drugs around. We should not be cursing them and just repeating all of these specious accusations against them. I mean, the first thing to say about pharmaceutical companies is, thank you. We owe our lives and the quality of our lives to you. And if you want to go produce a drug for more drugs for malaria, you're free to. Now, by the way, that is the fact that malaria is a problem is purely a product of the environmentalist movement, which I believe that you support, or certainly I'm sure many of your listeners support. And so the fact that
I mean, because DDT has been banned.
DDT is banned throughout the world is basically the cause of maybe, I don't know, tens of millions of malaria deaths. So,
well, you have mosquitoes that are resistant to DDT as well. You know, you can't just blame it on that. You can blame it on Darwin if you want.
Well, I mean, we would have to see about that. DDT bans from, you know, based on environmentalist propaganda decades long are still in place. So I would like to see those lifted, and then we can talk about alternative methods. But the first thing to say about malaria deaths are condemnation of the anti-human environmentalist movement. Condemnation of the life-saving pharmaceutical companies.
We're talking with Alex Epstein. He's with Ayn Rand, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Some of the seminal thinkers, the objectivists, the thinkers behind the thinkers who become the libertarians and conservatives, although I realize you guys are neither. Alex, my condemnation of Big Pharma is not the pharma part of it. You know, I think it's fine if somebody wants to go into the business of developing drugs and start a company and go out and do that and take those risks, you know, God bless them. My problem is the big part of Big Pharma. That if we don't have some sort of limits on the size of a corporation and on its ability to control market and market share and its ability to play games with things like the copyright laws, then what you end up with are companies that get bigger and bigger and bigger, and you've got nothing left in the marketplace but big fish, and they just don't let the little fish into the market.
Okay, well, I'd be happy to address that. I completely disagree with that, because there's the terminology of control market and market share is the important thing here. It's, what does that mean? I mean, let's say for a while Pfizer, quote, controlled most of the market for anti-impotence drugs. Well, why was that? It was because they created it. There was virtually no market for this. They created a new product. Many people voluntarily chose to buy it, and voila, you have a market. But to control a market only means that you are appealing to a large percentage of the buyers who voluntarily buy your product in any given category.
I'm not suggesting that it's one company controlling the market. I'm saying it's a handful of companies. It's like the oil industry.
That means is that these are the companies that are producing the most valuable products. If there were 50 other companies that could produce equally valuable products, then they would, quote, control it.
These are the companies that are the most effective at gaming the system.
Yeah, I would put it, they're earning market share. They're earning customers. That's what they're doing. They're not controlling is a bad term.
But they're using, for example, our patent laws, you know, to be able to extend their profits forever on products that should become.
Do you not think that there should be intellectual property?
I do think that there should be intellectual property, but I don't think the patent laws should be last. Frankly, I think 20 years is too long.
Yeah,
I think the ability to roll them over by simply changing, you know, the designer molecule a little bit so you have the same drug but different, I don't think that's right.
Well, okay, as far as the latter consideration, I don't know enough of the technical details there, so certainly you can argue about exactly how did the patent laws work. Now, in effect, they certainly don't have 20 years since it includes a long part of the FDA approval process, so I think there's a stronger argument that it should be longer. But the main thing here is I think it's an incredible injustice to harp on these accusations without acknowledging these people save our lives, thank you. It's not just fine, it's heroic what they do.
So, and therefore, if they're committing crimes in Africa, that's fine.
No, if they're committing crimes, then we should investigate them. But that doesn't change the fact that being a pharmaceutical producer is a virtuous activity, just as being a radio show host can be a virtuous activity, even if some of them tell lies.
AynRand.org. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Got my tonsils out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it healthcare, and I guess they got it good. Broke my arm in Amarillo, went to Cyprus for a sling. Cut a callus off in Cuba, and they didn't charge a thing. Went to Britain for my itching, and to Iceland for my eyes. Irish intern pulled a hairball out of me to my surprise. Got a mole removed in Malta, stomach stapled up in France. After I began to notice that...
Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's my problem with all this. And I'll just lay it right out. As I said, I don't have a problem with you know, people going into the pharmaceutical business. I've certainly in my life used pharmaceuticals, and I think most of us have to our benefit. Although, you know, obviously there are occasional problems, but nonetheless, that's a fine thing. My concern is this larger concern that the advocates of absolute unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism, of allowing corporations to get infinitely large to the point where they essentially can begin to corrupt the marketplace and corrupt science, corrupt governments, that's the point at which I think we have a real serious problem. This is what Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, this is what Teddy Roosevelt used to talk about all the time, about, you know, big corporations, about the trusts. And we've had a number of presidents talk about this over the years, and, you know, about the concept of trusts and the damage of trusts. And the bottom line is what they're talking about is corporations simply becoming so large and so powerful that they become institutions that are above and beyond the law, or they create the law. And it's simply not a good thing for the United States. I mean, just a very simple bottom line. For example, this an article by Nathan Newman in The Nation. He writes, in June, the New England, this is from July 25th, 2002, he says, in June, the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the most respected medical journals, made a startling announcement. The editors declared that they were dropping their policy stipulating that authors of review articles of medical studies could not have financial ties to drug companies whose medicines were being analyzed. Why? Because the journal could no longer find enough independent experts to be able to actually produce, you know, articles, research, and information about, you know, about medicine. An independent 1996 study found that 98% of scientific papers based on research sponsored by corporations promoted the effectiveness of a company's drug. 98%. At the most basic level, writes Nathan Newman in The Nation magazine, at the most basic level, researchers who defy their corporate sponsors know they may lose their funding. When one Toronto scientist revealed in 1998 a serious side effect of difluprone, a drug for blood disorder, her contract was terminated. More dramatically, when a number of researchers concluded that Remuni, an anti-AIDS therapy, was of little benefit to patients, the company funding their research, the Immune Response Corporation, sued the scientists for $10 million for damage to its business. In the early 1990s, a pharmacologist at the University of California in San Francisco, Betty Dong, found that a generic thyroid hormone worked as well as Synthroid, the brand name drug made by the funder of the research. According to the Washington Post, the company Knoll Pharmaceuticals successfully blocked publication of the findings for 7 years. So, I mean, this is the point at which, you know, I think it's important and incumbent on all of us, on Americans, to say, wait a minute, the Sherman Antitrust Act was really a good idea. It was actually a good idea to say that, you know, yes, you know, we want corporate activity, but we want a marketplace where the small companies can still get into it. We want a marketplace where companies don't get so large and so powerful that they can basically wipe out anybody who wants to try and compete with them. And, you know, we want to foster and encourage competition. You know, in the marketplace, we want that's a good thing, and that these very, very, very large corporate entities, and in this case, you know, Big Pharma, I mean, you know, look at all these, look, Billy Towson. Here's this congressman from Louisiana who's moving through the Medicare bill, and writes into the thing a stipulation which says that what is going to become the largest purchaser of prescription drugs in the United States, one of the largest purchasers, if not the largest purchaser of prescription drugs in the world, the United States government, has to buy at retail. Now, your local corner pharmacy can buy at wholesale. And they're just buying enough for, you know, 30 city blocks for the neighborhood. They can buy at wholesale. But the federal government has to buy directly from the companies at retail. Why? Purely and simply so that those companies can make more profit. And then Billy Towson goes to work for guess who? Pharma, the lobbying company for the big drug companies, at a salary of over $1 million a year. I mean, in fact, he gets a special waiver from Congress to go take that job before he's even, I mean, you know, before normally he would have even finished out his term. And it's just, the revolving door is just terrible. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I went in the darkness just searching for some place to be. Wasn't looking for trouble, I guess it was looking for me. And I knew I was wasting my time. But it was nobody's business but mine.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Teddy Roosevelt really captured this well. And I've got a clip here from Bill Clinton as well from his speech Monday night I want to share with you on the topic of health care in the United States. And we'll take a few of your phone calls, your thoughts on this as well. First, though, just to provide the frame, this from Sir James Goldsmith in 1993. He's since died, but at the time he was one of the wealthiest, five wealthiest men in the world. And billionaire speculator Sir James Goldsmith said, and I quote, "In the great days of the USA, Henry Ford stated that he wanted to pay high wages to his employees so that they could become his customers and buy his cars. Today, we are proud of the fact that we pay low wages. We have forgotten that the economy is a tool to serve the needs of society and not the reverse. The ultimate purpose of the economy is to create prosperity with stability." Sir James Goldsmith. Teddy Roosevelt. This is a speech he gave at the Ohio Constitutional Convention in Columbus, Ohio, in 1912. He said, "We are a business people. The great mass of business is, of course, done by men whose business is either small or moderate size. Middle-sized businessmen form an element of strength which is of literally incalculable value to the nation. Taken as a class, they are among our best citizens. They have not been seekers after earnest fortunes. They have been moderately and justly prosperous by reason of dealing fairly with their customers, competitors, and employees. The average businessman of this type, as a rule, is a leading citizen of his community, foremost in everything that tells for its betterment, a man whom his neighbors look up to and respect. He has no sense, he is in no sense dangerous to his community, just because he is an integral part of his community, bone of its bone and flesh of its flesh. His life fibers are intertwined with the life fibers of his fellow citizens. Then Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, says, so much for the small businessman and the middle-sized businessman. Now, for big business, it is imperative to exercise over big business a control and supervision which is unnecessary as regards small and medium-sized businesses. Big business in the past has been responsible for much of the special privilege which must be unsparingly cut out of our national life. The important thing, he said, is this. He says, I don't believe in making mere size oven by itself criminal. The mere fact of size, however, does unquestionably carry the potentiality of such grave wrongdoing that there should by law be provision made for the strict supervision and regulation of these great industrial concerns. He says, the important thing is that under such government recognition, we shall be most vigilant never to allow big corporations to crystallize into a condition which shall make private initiative difficult. We will protect the rights of the wealthy man, but we maintain that he holds his wealth subject to the general right of the community to regulate its business use as the public welfare requires. We grudge no man a fortune which represents his own power and sagacity exercised with entire regard to the welfare of his fellows. We stand for the rights of property, but we stand even more for the rights of man. Teddy Roosevelt, brilliant. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Let me just share with you, Bill Clinton. This is Monday night. I was in Seattle, and emceeing a gig with Congressman. I want to get to the Bill Clinton clip here. Congressman Jim McDermott, of course, and in fact, it was really a fundraiser for Jim McDermott. But and then Bill Clinton gave the keynote speech of the evening, as it were. Here's a little clip from it. Bill Clinton on health care.
Their answer to the health care problem is to further deconstruct the system, make it more inefficient, put more of the risk on people that can't do it, have the insurance pools be smaller, and have people bear unbearable risk. Look, all you got to, and we could talk about this tomorrow morning, but I just... You need to go out and say, people say there's no difference. Remember these facts.
Now, as he's going to get into some statistics here. It's really shocking because what it illustrates is a for-profit healthcare system being so much less efficient than the single-payer healthcare systems of other countries all around the world. These overhead, when Clinton cuts an overhead percentage, that's in most cases, that's money going right to the bottom line, going right into the pockets of stockholders, or the millions, or in the case of the second largest healthcare insurance company in the United States, the $1.5 billion in compensation he got last year. This is what Clinton's talking about here.
If you don't remember anything else I say, we spend 16% of our income on healthcare. The next most expensive rich countries in the world are Switzerland and Canada. They spend 11%. The difference in America between 11 and 16 is over $700 billion a year.
$700 billion a year. There's a reason why Bill Frist's daddy, who ran HCA, the big healthcare company, is one of the richest men in America, a multi-billionaire. That $700 plus billion a year.
One of the reasons is that our administrative cost for both insurers and providers of health care is 34%.
Now, keep in mind, Medicare's administrative cost is 3%.
No other country's administrative cost is over 19. That 15% difference is $280 billion a year.
$280 billion that, in large part, just ends up being profit.
Now, we insure 84%. Nobody else insures less than 100. And here's the last figure I want you to remember. General Motors has got $1,500 a car in health care costs. Toyota has 110. You tell me how we're going to preserve automobile manufacturing in America.
It's a good question. Again, this is even a simple matter of competitiveness.
And unbelievably enough, there was an article in the press yesterday. When Hillary and I sit around and read the papers in the morning, we trade off articles. And I found this one first, which tickles me. But I couldn't believe it. all these big companies with big health insurance plans are now paying their employees to go to Thailand and India to have surgery because they can save so much money. A lot of you nodding your heads. You probably saw it yesterday. Now, go figure. If you think that's a good system, by all means, support the Republicans. But if you would like to redirect that money into covering the uninsured and out of the administrative system and providing the most, you know, sort of modern management quality controls and having big insurance pools which lower administrative costs, the Medicare administrative costs about 3%, by the way, then you ought to be for us. And this, I could go through issue after issue after issue where their ideology will not let them look at the evidence.
And this was the theme of Clinton's speech was, you know, the how destructive Republican conservative ideology is. Jim McDermott, by the way, here, talking about the empty promises of Republicans when he was speaking on Monday night. Congressman Jim McDermott.
Sometimes I could turn back the clock just a little bit. I thought a little more and I said, no, I don't think so. After 10 years of Republican rule, America has empty pockets and empty gas tanks and broken promises. They ignore the Constitution, toss aside the Geneva Convention, out an undercover agent, look over our shoulder at the library, tap our phones in our home, pick our pockets at the pump, and keep sending special interest on tax holidays at your expense. Now, then they go out to lunch and plot what they're going to do in the afternoon. You all remember in the last election that really helpful color coding they had, that orange and yellow and all that stuff? Well, let me tell you something. It is code red in America today.
He is so right about that. I mean, democracy is seriously at risk, my friends, and we have to get politically active. More of Jim McDermott.
And the Republicans have found a new use for duct tape. It's for stopping people from talking. Now, they aren't just above the law. They just ignore them, or they undermine them, or they have special interests, rewrite the laws, or they simply attack anybody who tries to defend them. That's why we're here tonight. I'm trying to defend the people's right to know, and I needed a little help from my friends.
That was, you know, the fundraiser for Jim McDermott, in part to help pay his legal expenses, because John Boehner, all these guys have been suing him for 9 years because he had the audacity to share with the New York Times proof that Newt Gingrich was violating a commitment he'd made to the House Ethics Committee. And essentially, you know, breaking the law, going off like this. I mean, it's just incredible. Rich in Toledo, Ohio. Hey, Rich, just about a half.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to talk about our taxes a little bit on this. I was just wondering how many drugs came about from all the research grants that the government's given private companies and everything.
I was looking for that percentage this morning. I couldn't find it. I'm sure it's out there. Probably somebody in our chat room will track it down. But I know it's a good chunk. It's well over half of the research dollars that are used to develop pharmaceuticals in the United States are government grants to universities in large part.
And then also, you know, when they cry the blues about how much money they're putting out personally in research and everything, I believe with all the money that they're making and everything, they still get to write off just about every dollar they put out in research, so that comes right off their taxes. So
that's
it's
all.
Not
yeah,
like they're spending any money.
Yeah, see, well, they are spending money, but it's tax deductible, which means somebody's got to pay the taxes on that activity, which means you and I do. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. There's a lot going on in the world today, by the way, and in one of the more interesting things, what's going on in Alabama, where the the Justice Department is fixing to steal an election. I'll tell you about that, and we'll take more of your calls right after this. 45.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice. Truth be told, it's just a pack of lies. The last thing
And welcome back, helping you in the water cooler wars with Uncommon Sense and the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. You got to check out the editorial in today's New York Times. It's called Strong Arming the Vote. The Justice Department, George Bush's Justice Department, has gone down and stuck its nose into the workings of Alabama. In Alabama, the Secretary of State is a woman by the name of Nancy Worley. She's a Democrat. The governor is a Republican by the name of Bob Riley, who, by the way, won the governorship of Alabama at the last minute when the voting machines had to be recounted in the middle of the night. Yeah, that's a whole other story. You can go over to TomHartman.com and click on Articles on Democracy and click on the article entitled If you want to win an election, just own the voting machines. And you can find the whole story of Bob Riley. But in any case, I consider him an illegitimate Republican governor, one of many. So here we have a Democratic Secretary of State, Nancy Worley. The Secretary of State, of course, is the person who maintains the roll of who are the eligible voters. The Republicans, of course, they want to get people off that roll who might be Democrats. They pulled this in Ohio. They pulled 300,000 people off the rolls. They pulled this in Florida. They pulled almost 100,000 people off the rolls in order to guarantee Republican victories. Well, apparently they want to do it in Alabama, and yesterday did it in what the New York Times described as a kangaroo court. They gave Governor Riley, the Republican governor, control of the voter database. The New York Times editorial today points out the Justice Department's request to shift from Ms. Worley's powers to Governor Riley's extraordinary. The judge who did it, by the way, was named to the bench by President Bush. He would not let the Democrats even come in and argue their case. They note, the New York Times notes, the Justice Department's aggressive stance stands in marked contrast to the forgiving approach it has taken to Republican secretaries of state after Katherine Harris removed eligible voters from the rolls in Florida in 2000 and Kenneth Blackwell tried to block eligible people from registering in Ohio in 2004. Justice Department made no effort to limit their powers. Controlling the voter rolls can yield important advantages, as Ms. Harris proved in 2000. The Justice Department's actions in Alabama, I'm reading from the New York Times editorial here, appear to be less about enforcing the law than about wresting control of the voter rolls from the opposition party and making a Democratic Secretary of State who is up for re-election in a few months look bad. They wrap this thing up by saying the Justice Department is giving the impression that it is less concerned that elections be lawful and fair than that they come out a particular way. Amen. I mean, that's what it's all. They're fixing to steal another one. They're fixing to steal another one. And if the good citizens of Alabama don't stand up and speak out, they're going to do it. Because it's the only way Republicans can consistently win elections, is either by lying to the people or stealing the elections outright, because the Republican philosophy, the Republican perspective, is not what the majority of Americans want. The majority of Americans want decent wages, they want a national health care system, they want a clean environment, and they want we the people. They want a good public education system, and they want we the people to be running this country, not an elite bunch of very, very, very large corporations and very wealthy families. John in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, John, welcome to the program. John? John's not there. We'll put him on hold, and we'll try Leonard in Seattle. Hey, Leonard, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. I want to mention two things. First of all, I believe that you are probably the most informed person on issues of democracy on the airwaves today, and I really appreciate your insights. Secondly, I want to get back to the issues of capitalism and big farm and big oil. I wouldn't have a problem with these guys making, you know, having the profit motive, living with it, but we no longer have a government that works in balance. It's a subversion of capitalism to have this kind of support for big business.
Yeah, that's my point. This is, you know, laissez-faire capitalism eventually becomes basically feudalism. It basically becomes an oligarchy.
Yeah, it makes no sense because the government is not on the side of the people, the working class,
They don't have any balances. They don't go in and look at what's going on. And these issues make me ick. Just ill.
Yeah. Good point, Leonard. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for your kind words. I appreciate it. Dan in Phoenix. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was listening to your comments about it, the insurance issues, and while I agree with you, and I think that there's obviously an issue with the profit side of the insurance business, I think it's equally as important to talk about the issues related to insurance premiums that doctors pay because of the issues related to litigation. I mean, they're equally as large, if not larger. And I'm a small business owner. I pay $5,000 a month to employ insure 16 employees.
For health insurance.
I got a brother-in-law that's a doctor who can barely stay in business because his insurance premiums are six figures every year.
And the major reason why insurance companies, malpractice insurance premiums have gone up over the last 6 years is because the insurance companies that, you know, they sit on billions of dollars, right, their reserve pools. The insurance companies have invested that money in the market, and the market dropped in the late 1990s and early 2000. The drop in market value of insurance company assets is 5 to 1 over the cost of malpractice lawsuits in terms of having an impact on the premiums that your brother, who's the physician, is paying. And I'm surprised he doesn't know that and hasn't told you that.
Well, I happen to work in litigation, though, Tom. I mean, I'm in that business. I work in the technology side of litigation, and it's staggering to me to watch just the incredible volume. And you know, the trial lawyers of America are feeling it. They had to change their name this year.
I'm sorry, Dan. I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it. If people are injured, they should have a right to be compensated for it. And juries in this country are reasonable. Yeah, you hear the story about McDonald's. Turned out, you know, that verdict got reduced. I mean, rationality ultimately reigns. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
It's snowing in South Africa. It's not supposed to happen. You know, they say it's like, you know, occasionally we get sleet, but snow? No, it's snowing in South Africa as we speak. The world is taking notice. In fact, the headline, Agence France-Presse, rare snowfall across South Africa, just, you know, about a half hour ago. Chris Flavin is with us. Chris is the president of the World Watch Institute, worldwatch.org. Chris, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
Glad to have you here with us. You wrote an article here titled A Dying Planet. The Los Angeles Times right now is running a five-part series. You can find it over at their website, latimes.com, on how the oceans are becoming increasingly acidic, and this is killing off ocean life at a rate that had been previously considered inconceivable. These are just today's news stories. What's going on, Chris? How bad is it?
Well, collectively, we are just putting a huge burden on the environmental systems that really support our whole economy. You know, it's easy to get the impression when you're in a modern sort of post-industrial age that the environment is just sort of something nice over on the side that we enjoy on weekends. But we've got to remind ourselves that all of our food, many of our materials, the fish that we need, even the air that we breathe, they're really dependent on a healthy ecosystem. And the increasing scale of industrial activity and human consumption is just having enormous effects, from the impact on the ocean that you just described, to stress on our agricultural lands, to, I think, most fundamentally, the fact that we are changing the atmosphere in a way that is likely to provoke some quite dramatic change in the climate in the decades ahead.
The World Watch Institute, worldwatch.org, you publish a book every year, The Vital Signs.
And that's right.
Back when I was writing Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, it was a great resource for me going through, and a lot of that information was quoted in my book, you know, with credit, by the way. And you guys have been doing this for over a decade, maybe coming on two, something like that.
I think close to 20 years now for vital signs.
Okay. Yeah. And what are you seeing in terms of trend lines? I mean, is this linear or logarithmic? Are the changes starting to pick up really fast, or is it just that people are starting to notice it more?
Well, to take one specific example, and that is climate change. We're I think beginning to see some real signs of an acceleration, and the thing that's scariest about what we're beginning to see is that the impact that we're having on the climate through the greenhouse gases we're dumping into the atmosphere are beginning to cause what scientists call positive feedback loops. That is, natural systems themselves are beginning to release additional carbon dioxide, additional methane, and so the climate change could well start to speed up from what we've seen. And probably most alarmingly in terms of human impact, the melting of the world's glaciers, and particularly the big ice sheets that are in Antarctica and Greenland, could speed up rather dramatically. It's now pretty clear that there's sort of a fine line that you cross, sort of a tipping point with these ice systems. They don't melt gradually. They melt fairly rapidly and catastrophically once the dynamics are underway, so that you begin to have the water flowing down through the glaciers, lubricate them, they just start to collapse. So we could see an enormous amount of sea level rise, and when you add that on top of the destruction of wetlands, which was, you know, one of the things that really made the impact of Katrina as dramatic as it was, you're really looking at some decades ahead that could make, you know, even the recent disasters in the last few years look like a pretty routine occurrence.
Do you think we're looking at over the next 5 or 10 years, any real significant changes in sea levels, for example? Or obviously we're seeing weather patterns changing. The drought across the United States right now, for example, although some would argue, hey, you know, back in the 30s we had the Dust Bowl. There are obviously some natural cycles overlaying these. But is this a concern of... I mean, obviously it's a concern of immediacy. We have to do something to prevent the down the road consequences. But is this going to be in our face in the very near future, or is this something that we're looking a decade or a generation out at?
Well, unfortunately, I can't give you a clear answer to that, because scientists really can't look at it at that degree of granularity. I mean, knowing what's going to happen in the next few years, you know, it's literally beyond what we're capable of right now. There's certainly a good chance we'll see disasters, but just as Katrina and this, you know, spate of hurricanes that we've had the last 2 years were not predicted to be anywhere near severe, it's predicted to be an active season, but nothing like what we actually had. And certainly things like, you know, major droughts, there's been absolutely no ability to really predict that kind of thing. But I guess, you know, my suggestion would be to basically expect the unexpected. I think that we are, you know, in the midst of an unprecedented period of global change, and that is likely to spark a range of disasters that we can't forecast specifically.
Well, I live in a houseboat or a floating house on a river. Should I sell and move to high land?
Well, I guess the only good thing about that is you can sort of float as the sea level rises. But
well,
I would definitely keep an eye on your local weather forecast.
Yeah. This is you know, connected to the Columbia River that leads right out to the Pacific Ocean. My son and I were talking about this the other day. He's working on his master's degree in an area of science that relates to environmental sciences down at the University of Georgia, about the possibility of the methane hydrates in the ocean suddenly starting to go from solid to gaseous states. I mean, you talked about natural systems accelerating. I mean, there's this massive chunk of peat, you know, these huge areas of vegetation that are frozen in the tundras of Siberia, for example, about half the size of the continental United States, that are now starting, after 10, 11, 12,000 years, now starting to melt as a result of warming and releasing large quantities of methane, which is much more potent greenhouse gas than even carbon dioxide. Are we starting to see the possibility of the same thing coming out of the oceans?
I think that's a little more tentative. I think the release of methane from peat is something that appears to be more likely right now. The deep ocean temperature is, you know, pretty darn stable. That does not change nearly as much as the surface temperatures. So I wouldn't think that would be one of the early effects that we would see. But, you know, I think one of the things that I found most extraordinary in looking at some of the recent climate science is that there's a whole field called paleoclimatology now where scientists basically are able to look back, you know, both looking at ice records and also at geological records and to try to figure out what the climate was like, you know, millions of years ago. And what they conclude is that there have been just dramatic changes over time. And there was a time when, you know, there were literally, you know, tropical forests growing in what is now the North Pole. And there doesn't appear to have been any, you know, significant amount more sunlight in those Arctic regions then than there is now. Almost the entire difference appears to have been greenhouse gases. And so, you know, if it's possible to provoke climate change that's that dramatic, I think we've got a situation that is, you know, extraordinarily precarious. And the thing to remember is that while, you know, on the one hand it may seem, well, if the Earth has changed that much in the past, why should we be worried about it? It's never changed in any significant way during the roughly 10,000 years since human agriculture and cities began. So basically the period of modern civilization, we've had a relatively stable climate. Now suddenly we've got well over 6 billion people, a modern industrial economy, huge numbers of people living in vulnerable coastal areas, a food system that is already stretched to the limits, and suddenly we're talking about dramatically changing the climate on top of all of that. That is something that the human species needs to be very, very concerned about.
Chris, would I be accurate in suggesting that most of the solutions to this ultimately are going to have to be political, that the marketplace moves too slowly to react, that we need to be electing politicians who see this as a real crisis?
Well, I think it's actually a combination. We definitely need political leadership. We definitely need policy change. But, you know, a lot of the actual solutions are going to need to be delivered by, you know, individual people in the private sector, new
Sure.
technologies.
But shouldn't we be encouraging and supporting those like Jimmy Carter tried to do?
Absolutely. And we're beginning to see that happening, particularly at the state level. Federal government, I guess, as usual, is sort of behind the times, but we've got, you know, booming new industries in solar energy, wind power, biofuels, energy conservation. You know, you've suddenly got a lot of effort going into improved efficiency of automobiles and other things. So things are starting to move.
Chris Flavin, he's with the World Watch. He's the president of the World Watch Institute, worldwatch.org, the website. Chris, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And for all the work you guys are doing, it's marvelous. It's 16 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartmann radio program. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Here's the news. Coming to you every hour on the hour. The weather's fine, but there may be a meteor shower.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. You're in the real free speech zone, the Tom Hartmann radio program. Victoria Jones is with us, our senior Donald Rumsfeld fan club correspondent.
I was in the Senate Armed Services Committee this morning, and they were grilling Donald Rumsfeld, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Peter Pace, and General Abizaid. And you can't help but be a fan when you watch his performance.
Well, here's the 30-second clip of Don Rumsfeld talking to Hillary Clinton.
Well, Mr. Secretary, I know you would, and I know you feel strongly about it, but there's a track record here. This is not 2002, 2003, 2004, 5, when you appeared before this committee and made many comments and presented, you know, many assurances that have frankly proven to be unfulfilled. And
Senator, I don't think that's true. I've never painted a rosy picture. I've been very measured in my words, and you'd have a dickens of a time trying to find instances where I've been excessively optimistic. I understand this is tough stuff.
A dickens of a time.
A dickens of a time, yeah. And he started off, when she'd finished her cat-o'-nine-tails tirade, he started off by saying, golly. And
now, if we go back, let me just share a few quotes here with you. Go back to March 30th, 2003. He said, it happens not to be the area where weapons of mass destruction were dispersed. We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north, west, somewhat. In February 20th of 2003, do you expect the invasion, if it comes, to be welcomed by the majority of the civilian population? Asked Jim Lehrer on the News Hour. Rumsfeld answers, quote, there is no question but that they would be welcomed, referring to American forces. Here on February 7th, 2003, it is unknowable how long that conflict in Iraq will last. It could be 6 days, 6 weeks. I doubt 6 months. And then on December 18th, 2002, he was asked by John King, what's the current situation in Afghanistan? Rumsfeld, it's encouraging. They've elected a government through the Loya Jirga process. The Taliban are gone. Al-Qaeda is gone. Huh?
It was fascinating listening to many of the senators, including several Republicans, to hear the different world that those at the Pentagon apparently live in.
Mm.
It's a world of some optimism, although you did hear Abizaid saying that he'd never seen things as grim as this.
Abizaid was testifying before Congress today?
Abizaid, Pace, and Rumsfeld, all in the same room together.
So Rumsfeld had the generals who answered to him contradicting him?
On occasion, they did seem to. On occasion, he actually answered for them. He actually said things like, and if you ask General Abizaid, he would tell you such and such. And you could almost hear Abizaid rolling his eyes.
Really?
Yeah.
You were there, and you cover this stuff, and you're close enough to these people to get a sense of their body language and their tonality and you know what's going on. What's your take on Don Rumsfeld? Is he a guy who, you know, he's in his 70s, which is, you know, nothing wrong with that in and of itself, but for some folks, age can be a challenge. Is he a guy who's starting to lose it, or is he some kind of weird control freak, or is he really, you know, at the top of his game and the rest of us are all missing something?
I think he's some kind of weird control freak. I don't think he's lost it at all.
Yeah.
I think he absolutely believes what he's saying.
But it's contradicted by evidence.
So?
Oh, I see.
What's your point?
Yeah, well, I guess you and I live in that reality-based world.
Yeah.
As Bill Clinton said Monday night at this gig that I was emceeing in Seattle, he said, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic family. I spent my childhood trying to get into the reality-based world. I rather like it here.
You know? Oh, really? Well, that's very interesting. What an interesting statement.
Yeah. Yeah, but the Republicans they make fun of the reality-based world, and so.
Well, sometimes right. They do. I also attended a very interesting press conference by Senators Reid, Schumer, Durbin, and Harkin on stem cell research, where they were urging President Bush to overturn his own veto, basically. And Senator Reid was basically saying, you know, to the president, all you have to do is to say to your Republican friends in Congress, I made a mistake. And so, you know, and Senator Harkin said, I don't like to disagree with my leader, but quite frankly, sir, fat chance.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. I mean, is there actual hope that, or was this just, you know, for...
They say the hope is in November. That's where they see the hope.
Yeah, in November. And by the way, I just saw the polls here. Ned Lamont has now pulled 13 points ahead of Joe Lieberman.
It's really quite extraordinary.
It's amazing. Is this going to be a national trend? Are we going to start seeing, quote, centrist Democrats, that is, Democrats who take positions that are essentially Republican positions, are being increasingly challenged by progressive Democrats?
I actually think Connecticut's unique in this case, because I really don't think that there are many other centrist Democrats who've taken quite the view on the war that he has. And who have been seen to be so closely aligned with Bush.
Well, you have Hillary Clinton who's still supporting him. Maria Cantwell's still supporting him. I mean, there's a good handful of them out there.
There are, but I think Hillary's been seen to be more loyal as a Democrat down the line, and she's got the husband, and she's also been more outspoken. She has been critical of the war, or at least of the handling of the war, in ways that Lieberman hasn't.
Yeah, and the same with Maria Cantwell, and good on a lot of other issues as well.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you for the report today
from
Washington, D.C. Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour right here on the Radio Support Group. Bye-bye and for We the people of the United States of America.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell?
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. On Monday of this week, I was up in Seattle and emceeing a gig, a fundraiser for Congressman Jim McDermott, one of the finest members of the United States House of Representatives, who has been under 9 years of relentless legal harassment by Newt Gingrich's bunch and headed up by John Boehner, whatever. And Bill Clinton spoke at this thing, and those of you who are regular listeners to this program know that I have some differences with some of Bill Clinton's policies, particularly with regard to international trade and his signing the Telecommunications Act. But he did a lot of good as a president as well. And the thing that really struck me, the thing that really, frankly, surprised me about the speech that he gave in Seattle on Monday night was how he just came right out and laid out the big picture stuff, the stuff that we talk about on this program all the time, that I almost never hear politicians talking about. I mean, you'll hear Bernie Sanders talk about it from time to time, but by and large, this is, you know, it's not the quick soundbite. It's not the easy shot stuff, and that is the idea that a small chunk of the Republican Party has taken over the United States. Not even the Republican Party has taken over the United States. I mean, this is not even the Republican Party that is running the House, the Senate, and the White House, and the Supreme Court. It is a small slice, a cult within the Republican Party that is ideological rather than philosophical. And frankly, you know, not healthy to the United States. And Bill Clinton talked about this. He just came right out and talked about it, straight up. And I was very impressed. And I just want to share some pieces of this with you. Here's Bill Clinton from Monday night.
Because there really is a huge sort of philosophical difference between the two parties, deeply held, that has policy and political implications and produces very different results for the American people.
Now, that's the difference in philosophy between the two parties. And what he's suggesting is that that's a fine thing. In fact, that's a healthy thing, that there be a difference in philosophy between the two parties. But then we get to the guys who are running the country now.
They honestly believe the source of America's greatness is in its big companies and wealthy elite. And we believe the source of America's greatness is in its middle class and the promise that everybody who works can be rewarded for it. And they, therefore, their primary goal when they get political power is to literally to concentrate wealth and power.
And this is such an important point, that the core idea of conservatives, and this is conservatives are right up front about this. I mean, just, you know, read the writings, the classic writings of conservatives, that the greatness of a nation is measured by. Or it's not measured by, it's a result of the power of a small number of very wealthy individuals and the power of the large institutions. And the idea on which this country was founded, the liberal ideas of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, were that the greatness of a country is derived from its middle class, from a wide and broad and deeply educated populace that participates in governance.
That's what they believe they should do. And so to them, there's nothing at all wrong with running these kind of unbelievable crony capitalist operations they run. All these no-bid contracts and
Now, he's talking here, again, about the conservative worldview that the greatness of a country comes from a wealthy few.
...and money in Iraq and having by far, even more than in the Reagan years, the largest number of people in charge of health and environmental regulations coming right out of the industries they were supposed to regulate because it concentrates wealth and power. There was nothing wrong in ballooning the cost of the Medicare drug program and having it written so that only Albert Einstein had a big enough brain to understand it, because they had to cut in the drug companies and the insurance companies because that's what they do, transfer middle-class people's tax money to them and make it the only program that we now, it's the only big purchasing program for pharmaceuticals anywhere in America where the purchaser is by law prohibited from bargaining for lower prices for big volume purchases. The VA hospital does it, General Motors does it, every large employer does it. Only you as a taxpayer can't do it because that's not what the providers and the insurers wanted. But that's what they believe they should do, to concentrate wealth and power. And because they believe that, they favor a government that is secretive, unaccountable, and constantly increasing executive authority, even if it requires the president to write, listen to this, 750 signing statements on federal legislation, basically saying, I know what Congress said, but that's not the way I read it. We believe in government that is open, accountable, and empowering to people. And it's just a different view. And they believe in their ideology. Most of us have a philosophy.
This is a real important distinction, and one that I'm just so pleased to hear Clinton making.
The country has been very well served for a long, long time now by having two philosophically different parties. One philosophically more conservative, one philosophically more liberal. But if you have a philosophy, it means you're interested in, it means you're inclined by your values in a certain direction. But you're also interested in hearing arguments and looking at facts. And you actually think you might be wrong every now and then. But if you have an ideology, then the facts are irrelevant. The result is determined, and then you just fix the facts to fit them.
To paraphrase the Downing Street memo, you know, I suspect that was no accident. Bill Clinton continues.
So they favor ideology, and we like evidence. And because they have already got their minds made up, they think argument is the province of weak minds, and they prefer attack. So they attack to support their ideology. We argue to support our evidence to bolster the philosophical direction we think the country should go in. So if you favor ideology and attack, you need to be for them. If you favor evidence and argument, you need to be for us. And they also... And they need a divided America to win. They need an enemy. They need a sort of a tribal mentality. And they need to sloganeer. Or as Newt Gingrich once said to me in a remarkable moment of candor, I hate it the way we do you, but if we fought you fair, you'd beat us every time. And they have to convince people we're somehow unworthy because they can't win an argument. So it's got to be a divisive, turn your brain off, kind of a deal. Whereas we favor an inclusive community. We'd like for people to get together and have a reasoned argument and figure out what's best for America and go forward. When they are more reasonable, it's amazing what we do. I mean, Hillary's co-sponsored a bill with Senator Frist in the Senate to give electronic medical records to every single American citizen and all providers. It would cut the administrative cost of health care $100 billion dollars or more a year. The Rand Corporation says $160 billion a year. And I hope it'll pass, but they've fooled around with it now for almost 2 years and hadn't passed it.
Well, gee, if it's going to cut costs $160 billion a year, that means it's going to cut the profits of all these big corporations, so it's unlikely that's going to pass, right?
When my wife went with John McCain to the northernmost village on Earth up in Norway where they to study the effects of global warming, they dragged a bunch of Republican recalcitrants up there to try to prove it wasn't a myth. I thought this was... I thought this was a good thing, but it's a rare thing. Because most of Washington is dominated by this sort of ideology, and therefore we have very different policies.
And that's the fundamental point that Clinton made in his speech. That I thought probably the most important point. He gave a whole lot of examples of it on the economy, on health care, on other issues. And he's starting to talk, like Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt in some ways, you know, about the difference between ideology and philosophy, the notion that they're, you know, that living in the evidence-based world, the reality-based world, is a good and healthy thing, that we should be coming together and having conversations about how things are and how things should be, rather than simply calling each other names and constantly trying to attack each other, and trying to bring about some sort of a reasonable middle ground where we can all live together, thank you very much, without sounding too much like Rodney King, where we can all live together and have a decent life, where we can have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, like the founders envisioned for this country. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our toll-free telephone number all across the United States. Well, all over the planet, I think it'll get you through. And TomHartman.com, our website if you want to check in. One of the folks in the chat room said, is there a place where we can hear Clinton's entire speech? It runs about 32 minutes. And yes, if you go to 620kpoj.com, the website for the radio station where I do a morning program here in Portland, Oregon, 620kpoj.com. The speech is online there, and you can hear the entire thing. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom, I was just wondering, you know, there's a lot of good deeds happening in this country. And one was forgotten. It happened August 1st, 1946, down in Athens, Tennessee, when returning GIs from the Second World War was disgruntled, you know, about the ballot box fixing. So they stormed the courthouse, the jailhouse down in Athens,
mm-hmm.
and they had a shootout. And that kind of stopped things for a while, you know, about politicians stuffing the ballot boxes.
That's interesting. That's a piece of history that had eluded me, Jim. I didn't know about that. And that's on this day in history, huh?
Well, no, not this day, August 1st, 1946. I'm sure it would be on Associated Press and that.
Yeah.
Just put the Athens jailhouse raid, you know, by the Second World War vets.
Well, that's what's happening in Mexico right now. You've got people creating tent cities, you know, camping out, saying that they want the vote recounted. Whether López Obrador won or lost, they want all 41 million votes to be actually recounted. Let's find out what the real vote
was. I have an interesting question about this now, Tom, and I would like your opinion if you have one on it. Okay, now, these are citizens of the United States stopping somebody from overthrowing the type of rights that we have in this country. Would they be considered patriots or terrorists?
Who's the they you're talking about now?
The GIs that wanted to save, you know, their way of voting.
Well, obviously, I would consider them patriots.
So would I. I'm glad to hear you know, say it, because I question sometimes. They say, well, you're violating the law by doing this. I said, no, you're protecting your country's rights.
There are times when it is important to violate the unjust laws or, you know, I mean, that's the essence of what Martin Luther King did. It was against the law for him to do many of the things that he did, and he said these laws are wrong. And, you know, I'm not an advocate of lawlessness in general, but I salute these guys for what they did.
We're prisoners of our politicians right now. I mean, they try to make criminals out of office so they can just say, you don't have any rights, you're a criminal.
Increasingly. And Bush is passing around this legislation now, and members of Congress are trying to get a hold of it because the Washington Post reported on it yesterday, but it hasn't been given to at least any Democrats in Congress yet, that would basically give him the power, Jim, to throw you in Pittsburgh or me here in Oregon into jail any old time he wants and just throw away the key. Just lock us up and throw away the key. Say, well, you know, Fifth Amendment rights, Sixth Amendment rights, Seventh Amendment rights, Eighth Amendment rights. Forget it. They don't matter. You don't need a trial by jury. It's, you know, it doesn't.
Well, which one of them said the Constitution was only a piece of paper?
Yeah. Well, according to blueoregon.com, that was George W. Bush. Jim, I got to move along.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Good to hear from you. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, what's up?
Now, Tom, you know I'm on your side, but I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Last hour you said unbridled capitalism leads to feudalism.
I should say unregulated, yeah.
Okay. European-style feudalism, I think, grew out of the collapse of the Roman Empire, and modern capitalism came about as a result of the plague of 1349. Now, am I oversimplifying here?
Yeah, well, actually, I think you could argue that the Roman Empire was an example of laissez-faire capitalism. You know?
Really? I never thought about that.
Yeah, and it imploded on itself. And you could argue also, some people do very cogently, that Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself in the 1930s, that, you know, by imposing the controls on capitalism that prevented it from repeating what happened in 1929. And as far as modern capitalism coming out of the Black Plague, you know, the whole time in the 1300s, that goes back to the whole issue of labor. What you saw was about a third of the population, as I recall, a quarter or a third of the population vanishing, you know, dying as a consequence of the plague over
right.
a period of years there. And thus the demand for labor was driven up to the point where the price of labor was driven up to the point where a middle class emerged, and that middle class then began unions, they were called guilds at the time, to hold on to their power, because as population started growing to the point where labor was actually starting to meet demand, they wanted to maintain that middle class, and a whole variety of devices over the 500 years since then, have been put into place or 700 years since then to maintain that, things like labor unions and laws against children participating in the workplace and things like that, and thus the middle class came about. But I'm not sure the relationship to capitalism there. I would not say that that's when capitalism came about. It's been
it provided the opportunity.
Well, capitalism is basically somebody investing in something and then living off the product of that investment. I mean, most people who call themselves capitalists actually aren't. They're actually participating in free enterprise. They're business people, small business people. A capitalist is somebody who invests their money and then they live off the return on the capital, and that, you know, beginning and end. Whereas somebody who runs a business isn't a capitalist, they're a business person. So I'm not, you know, capitalism, I'd say, goes all the way back to Sumeria, KJ. You can find in the old pottery shards there in Uruk, Gilgamesh's giant city that he built 7,000 years ago, the very oldest, first known civilization. You can find records of people who were investing. So I'd say it's been around for a long, long time. We'll be back after the news. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, Truth in Broadcasting, for a change in America. Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting story. This I have the L.A. Times version of it. I noticed yesterday Lou Dobbs going on about it, and perhaps others, other news programs. Undercover investigators repeatedly entered the United States using fake documents this year at 9 crossings at the Mexican and Canadian borders without challenge. Government Accountability Office said border agents, quote, never questioned the authenticity of the counterfeit documents, end quote. The GAO concluded this vulnerability potentially allows terrorists or others involved in criminal activity to pass freely into the United States from Canada or Mexico with little or no chance of being detected, end of quote. I think we're getting hysterical here. I just have to say, I think we're getting hysterical. I lived most of my life, the first half of my life anyway, in Michigan, and just, you know, 100 miles from the Canadian border. I lived for 10 years in Vermont, 2 hours south of the Canadian border. I have traveled in and out of Canada, you know, crossed the border between the United States and Canada, I don't know how many times in my life, at least 40, 50 times. I mean, we would drive through Canada to get from Vermont to Michigan because it was a shorter shot across southern Canada than it was to take I-80 around, you know, through Ohio and everything to go home on holidays. When Louise and I lived in Detroit, when our oldest daughter was born, we were living in Westland and near Livonia. It's where our oldest was born in, what was it, 72, I think, 73. And we used to go over to, you know, just cross the border and go over to Windsor, Canada for meals. I mean, there's some great restaurants and things. I mean, it's, I've crossed the border, you know, down in in Southern California, the border down toward Tijuana a couple of times as well. And I've never had anybody take my ID and go check it out and make sure it's real. I mean, just think about it for a minute. You've got these long lines of people. What happens is the customs agents, they look at you, they look at your car, they see that you've got U.S. driver's license, you know, license plates. They engage you in conversation. You know, hey, you know, where are you going? Oh, we're driving through. We're heading over to Michigan. Why are you going there? Well, you know, it's Christmas. We're going back to share the holiday with our family. That's where we're from. Where were you born? I was born in Michigan. Born in Grand Rapids. So how long are you going to be there? Oh, I'll be there about a week. And by that time, that agent knows that, you know, but listening to the accent, I'm not saying, well, it'll be a boot a week. He knows that I'm an American, not a Canadian. A U.S. citizen, to be technically correct. Canadians, I know they live in North America too, for the word freaks out there. But anyhow, the point is, I think they're doing a fine job. And I think there is this hysteria, this xenophobia. There's certainly an element of racism, particularly associated with those who are hysterical about our southern border. But I think for most, it's just plain old gut fear. Fear that has been whipped up by the Bushies. You know, they've been using 9/11 the same way that Hitler used the Reichstag to increase and consolidate power in the office of one single man. And it's not a good thing for this country. The fact that our borders, that it's been relatively easy to cross our borders, and it's not like, you know, when I come back into the United States from flying overseas, you know, you fly in from London or something, you go to an airport, you stop at the airport, well, you got to go through passport control, and you got to show your passport, and they run it through the machine and check it out, and yep, that's you. And, you know, I understand that. If somebody could be coming from pretty much anywhere. But we have such a large border with Canada, it's a couple of thousand miles. We've got over 1,000 miles of border with Mexico. There's no way we can seal those things. So the question ultimately, what it comes down to, is security, right? We don't want criminals and we don't want terrorists coming into the United States. So how do you establish that security? You do it by having a foreign policy, and for that matter, domestic policy, that makes you secure, that doesn't cause people to want to come and blow up your country. If we became energy independent so that we didn't have to be messing around in the Middle East constantly trying to protect our oil supplies, we'd have a whole lot fewer people in the world thinking that maybe they should be trying to blow up our buildings. If we were to have rational drug policies in the United States and deal with illegal, what are currently illegal drugs, as medical problems rather than criminal problems, and by and large decriminalize at least the soft drugs, it would break the back of organized crime. You'd empty millions of people out of our prisons. It would take a huge burden off taxpayers. I mean, $50,000 a year to incarcerate somebody for smoking pot? Come on. And you wouldn't have these organized crime gangs operating on the Mexican border, and this is really simple stuff. It's not rocket science. Let's be good citizens of the world. I mean, in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, you could just as easily walk across the border from Mexico to the United States. Why didn't we have an illegal immigration problem back then? Well, because you couldn't get a job here, because the unions were strong. If you weren't a citizen. Well, Reagan and Bush and the two Bushes, they did away with that one in a hurry. So we need to go back to enforcing reasonable policies and say, hey, if you want to work in the United States, you have to be a citizen of the United States. And you can demonstrate that with a Social Security number. You don't have to go through, we don't need a national ID card. You don't need to have an RFID chip planted under your skin. I mean, this is the direction that these guys are taking us. If they can whip up enough fear, if they can get enough people hysterical enough, they're going to end up injecting under your skin an RFID chip on the premise of, well, you do want to be able to be identified as an American when you cross the border, don't you? But really, what it's going to be all about is if you happen to be in the crowd that's protesting Senator Schmo or President Bush, probably around the time that Jeb is running for president, then they can just drive by with a drive-by scanner and go, oh, yeah, look at who's in the crowd. We've got all our information. And the corporate and the big multinational corporations, they'll love it. You walk in every store you walk into, they'll know where you are. I mean, it's just like right now, you travel around the Internet. If you don't have any security turned on in your web browser, they'll throw a cookie on your computer, and they'll know every single website you've been on and how long you stayed there. And how deep you went into that website. And if they're going to go to all that trouble to figure that out for somebody who's just browsing the web, think how just they've got to be salivating at the idea of being able to do that with every single individual, every single person who's walking around in the United States. The direction that these guys are leading us with this, we have a lapse in security at our borders. Oh, that's a terrible thing. Let's get hysterical about it. The direction they're leading us is where you end up with a society where the knock comes in the middle of the door in the middle of the night and people vanish, or where as you're walking down the street, somebody comes up to you in uniform and says, may I see your papers, please? You know, how dare you be at this rally? Oh, you're a member of the White Rose Society, the students who decided that they were going to oppose Hitler. Hauled them off and murdered them. I mean, this is the direction of totalitarianism. Totalitarianism is the response to terror among the people. The people of the United States are being terrorized, and they're not being terrorized by Osama bin Laden. They're being terrorized by those who would use fear as a political tool in the United States. And if we simply look at the history of this country, and say, no, you know, being a good citizen of the world and having reasonable domestic policies that don't oppress people within the United States, this is the greatest insurance for our security. Absolutely the greatest. I mean, we had, at one point, our country was actually invaded, occupied. The White House was burned down by British troops in the War of 1812. We didn't have to suspend the Bill of Rights then. What are we, spitting in the face of the founders? 16 minutes past the hour. After the break, taking our country back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Work fair, foul air, homeless beggars everywhere, picture phone aristocrats lounge around the pool. Captains of industry smiling beneficently, leaky hose, super tanker, ship of fools.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. He's speaking of trickle-down blood. 1981, labor took a hit. Blood wasn't spilled. Life wasn't lost. But August 3rd, 1981, this day in history, this from HistoryChannel.com, still stands as one of the darkest days in modern labor history. This was the day that Ronald Reagan officially declared war on working people in the United States. As HistoryChannel.com notes, tired of working clock-busting shifts and obsolete equipment, 13,000 members of the U.S. Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO, chose this day to walk off the job. President Reagan fired back, threatening to fire any workers who were still on the picket line as of August 5th. A good chunk of the controllers stood their ground, though their determination wasn't matched by the media and public relations savvy that now seemed necessary for mustering up public support. Having seemingly won the battle of public perception, Reagan made good on his promise, citing a law that forbade strikes by federal employees. He canned 11,500 strikers and decertified the union. Crop of replacement controllers was rounded up, trained, and quickly installed in the vacant positions. The PATCO strike ultimately triggered a protracted retreat by labor as Reagan's tactics emboldened employers to take a more aggressive stance against union activity. That on this day in history. Now, that was in 1981. Today, we're trying to raise the minimum wage. And the Republicans are saying, yeah, sure. We'll let you vote on that. Because, you see, even the ability to vote on something in the House or Senate is in the control of the Republicans right now. I mean, whether or not something even gets voted on. There have been issues where a majority of people were in favor, you know, a majority of members of the House or the Senate were in favor. Votes just don't come up because the leadership doesn't want the vote to come up. Well, here with this minimum wage, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office issued a memo today analyzing the language. Barbara Boxer requested this, a Democrat from California. Analyzing the language of the minimum wage law, that's, you know, they're putting this thing forward and saying, well, yeah, we'll let you raise the minimum wage. Well, in Alaska, California, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Minnesota, and Nevada, plus the territory of Guam, what this minimum wage increase will do is cause people who work for the minimum wage plus tips to see their minimum wage dropped to $2.13 an hour. We're talking millions of people. I mean, these Democrats, they think that they're so slick, or these Republicans, excuse me, they think they're so slick on this thing. It's just, as David Saracen writes in the Oregonian in an editorial today, he says, in an additional bit of cleverness, The House bill overrides state minimum wage laws that don't count tips against the minimum wage. So the policies of Oregon, Washington, California, Alaska, Nevada, two other states. The Oregon minimum wage right now is $7.50 plus tips. Washington State's minimum wage, $7.63 plus tips. Both according to the will of the state voters, by the way. The clever new House plan would drop them both as low as the federal level of $2.13, with tips expected to get them the rest of the way. Ain't it marvelous? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. By the way, Jack Cafferty, I'll tell you, when you get old-line Republicans, I mean, Jack Cafferty's an old-fashioned Republican, a classic, you know, a Republican with some integrity, I would submit to you, talking like he's been talking lately, you know that the right-wing cranks who've taken over the party have a problem. Here's Jack Cafferty in the Situation Room yesterday.
Well, somebody's finally worked up the nerve to say it out loud. We have a constitutional crisis in this country. So says Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. He's the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee. And in an upcoming report, he describes what he calls an alarming pattern by the Bush administration of operating outside the law and with no meaningful oversight by Congress. Conyers says the Bush administration may have broken a total of 26 separate laws and regulations, including misleading Congress and the American people about the decision to go to war in Iraq, manipulating intelligence about the justification for the war, encouraging torture and degrading treatment of prisoners in Iraq, allowing inappropriate retaliation against critics, and approving unlawful domestic... Conyers says these things have happened because a Republican-controlled Congress has refused to do its job of providing oversight and conducting formal investigation into this stuff, thus allowing an unchecked abuse of power on the part of the White House. We called the White House for a response to all of this, but instead of addressing any of the questions that are raised by Congressman Conyers, we were told to call the Republican National Committee.
Yes, this is like... In the Soviet Union, all questions are referred to the Communist Party. It's one-party rule, after all. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. Program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, to get all things Macintosh, all things iPod, really all things PC even as well. Give them a call and tell them we said hi. Time to check in on what's going on in the with the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of Thursday, as of 0900 GMT, this is from Reuters. Dateline Musayab, three people were killed and 22 wounded Wednesday night when gunmen attacked a wedding party with hand grenades. In Balad, three Iraqi soldiers were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol. In Baghdad, two civilians were wounded when a roadside bomb targeting police commandos exploded in the Zayuna district. In Wajahia, Gunman attacked the house of a police officer, killing three women and a man from his family on Wednesday night in that town. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army arrested 49 insurgents and killed 15 in the last 24 hours in various cities in Iraq. That Dateline Baghdad, I guess. In Kut, police found the body of a former member of Saddam Hussein's ousted Ba'ath party in that city. In Noumania, police retrieved a body from the river in that town. The body bore signs of torture and was handcuffed with shotgun wounds. In Dujail, police found the bodies of three people shot dead on Wednesday. In Samarra, a decomposed body was found in that city. In Ishaqi, gunmen kidnapped a food contractor for the Iraqi army on Wednesday. And that's our report from, sadly, our report from the campaign strategy of the Bush administration, 2002, 2004, and probably 2006, also known as the invasion and occupation of Iraq. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. I want to play another one of these clips from Bill Clinton here. First, John in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Am I on?
You are. What's up?
Okay. Yeah, I've been listening in spurts today, but you started off with the Ayn Rand character, and I appreciate that you put those guys on. And I totally understand why you can't call a fascist, but the overall, just like what you were just talking about what the Bush administration is attempting to do to the Bill of Rights again, these people, they say that the open market and the corporations, basically we should all get down on our knees and thank them for curing us, et cetera. And basically, in my opinion, they are akin. What he's suggesting is, you know, that eventually there's going to be one corporation, and the person or group that owns the majority of the stock of that corporation will run the world. Along the lines of Islam, where God, and we should all get down and we should all pray to a God, we'll all get down and we'll all thank this one corporation for letting us exist.
Well, first of all, this is not unique to Islam.
Right.
The Catholics did a fine job with the same thing in Europe for about 1,000 years. Secondly, although I'm not disagreeing with you here, John, secondly, I wouldn't call the Ayn Rand guys fascists because they actually believe that government and business should be separate entities, and they would be the first to be opposed to government regulation, whether it helps or hurts business. And fascism, the definition of fascism, as Mussolini came up with it, is the merging of corporate and state interests. But I think the best contemporary example, I don't know if you heard the interview that I did yesterday, I believe it was, with the author of this new book about, it's called The Sack of Rome, about the rise of Silvio Berlusconi. And here's a guy who started out as a small-time crook and a small-time businessman and bought a radio station and then bought another one and then bought a TV station and bought another one and bought a newspaper, bought a magazine, had a couple other industries as well. He started out actually in the real estate business and bought a TV network and then bought a radio network and then bought another TV network and then bought another. Pretty soon he owned the media that was listened to or read by over 90% of all Italians. He basically owned all the media of Italy, with the exception of the state-run media. Well, let me just finish this, and then you will. Sure. And then he ran for office. Yeah.
Can I respond to the Ayn Rand thing?
Yeah.
And also to the Islam thing. What I meant was the Islamo-fascists, that the Islamo-fundamentalist fascists, and also with the Ayn Rand, they don't believe in government having control over corporations. They believe in corporations having total control, and if one or two corporations gets total control, then that is the government.
Yeah, well, that's where their philosophy breaks down, and Ayn Rand just, you know, she made the mistake of thinking that capitalism was a form of governance because she grew up in the Soviet Union. She, you know, studied politics at the University in Kiev and believed that it was capitalism versus communism.
It's interesting that you should bring up the Soviet Union and what's going on in Russia right now, because we are, some of us are casting stones at Putin, and yet what Putin is doing is basically akin to what George Bush and his gang are attempting to do here, except for one thing. Putin has basically paid off the Russian debt.
And Putin is also dancing with the oligarchs by and large. I mean, he put one of them in prison and said to the rest of them, basically, okay, you guys, you can be billionaires. I'll let you be billionaires. You know, we can work this thing out. But if you cross me, you go to jail. And not only do you lose your billions, but you rot in jail. I mean, Lukos or the oil company? And I'm forgetting the name of the oligarch, the guy that he threw into jail. But, Putin's got it figured out. I mean, he's no dummy. He knows what he's doing.
And I'm not endorsing him or anything, but the fact is, the reason he's gotten away with a lot of what he's getting away with is because of what's going on here. And they say, how can you cast stones at us when you're doing what you're doing over in America?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, John. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. I just happened to hear the great distinction. President Clinton, who I still wish was president, and I'm sure there are a lot of others out there. Distinction, and if I may, for years and years and years, I always said to anybody that was interested in just hearing an opinion that there's a huge difference philosophically in the parties. What I missed was where Bill Clinton, the distinction is, they don't even really are based on a philosophy.
That's his point. They're based on an ideology.
Yes, yes, and I knew they had that framework. That's what their core was, but I didn't know how to quite articulate it. To hear Bill Clinton say that was just fantastic.
He did a great job. Thank you very much, Gary. In fact, here's a little bit more of Bill Clinton on this issue. This on the economy.
The economy, they said we had to have tax cuts mostly for wealthy people. I love saying this because I never had any money till I got out of the White House. And now, I never thought the president would take such good care of me as he does. But it's wrong, but he does it. But they cut taxes for the wealthy because they said we had to get rid of the surplus. And they did a good job of that, all right. And then they said, oh, now we're in a recession. We got to cut taxes for the wealthy again. And now they say, oh, the economy's growing. The answer is to get rid of the estate tax. I mean, every time you turn around, it doesn't matter what the facts are, it's the ideology. And now they've started bragging about how the deficit is only $300 billion a year. And they want somebody to give them a gold star. This is the thinking of ideologues. It's very important that you understand this. And it's the most important thing. Mr. Rowe said the other day he was going to run against us as the pre-9/11 party, and we live in a post-9/11 world. Well, let's look at that. The 9/11 Commission made a lot of recommendations about security changes. And one of the most important to you in Seattle is that we do a much better job of inspecting the cargo containers at our ports and airports. Now, I'm going to give you two examples, and Jim McDermott will back me up. Before the 2004 election, the House Democrats attempted to pass a measure to double cargo container inspections, because we only inspect 5% of them. And they had a security report that said if you don't check 10 to 20%, you have no deterrence at all. Might as well not check any. So you've got to check 10 to 20%. So Congressman Obie from Wisconsin offered a bill that said we'll go from 5 to 10% and at least get the minimum threshold.
And that's like the beginning. Obie offers this bill, and Clinton then tells the story of what happens next as a result of this small group of ideologues running the Republican Party rather than having a philosophy. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's gonna pay the bill? Who's gonna pay the bill? Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those
chicken hawks on Capitol Hill. Not the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill. $1 billion a day.
Well, now it's up to $2 billion a day. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We were just listening to Bill Clinton. This is a talk he gave Monday night that I was emceeing for Congress, a fundraiser for Congressman Jim McDermott up in Seattle, to help him with the legal bills around his the 9 years that he's been harassed legally by Congressman Boehner over over Jim McDermott outing Newt Gingrich for lying to the American people and to the House Ethics Committee. I mean, the Republicans, not only do they punish year after year after year after year. McDermott spent some $400,000 on legal bills so far on this thing. So Bill Clinton came to town as a part of a fundraiser for him. So anyhow, Bill Clinton is giving this talk, and he's talking about the difference between somebody who has a philosophy, and he started out saying, you know, Republicans and Democrats have different philosophies, but you can argue philosophy. You can debate the facts. You can have differences of opinion and still be reasonable. But an ideology or an ideology, depending on what part of the country you come from or the world, an ideologue is somebody who is absolutely convinced of the rightness of their position, and they don't need evidence of that. In fact, they will change the facts to conform with their belief, which is a perfect description of the Bush administration right now. So he talks about how David Obey, the senator from Wisconsin, had proposed legislation that would inspect 10% of the containers coming into the United States. Brought this, you know, before the Senate. And here Clinton finishes the story up here on this.
But they had to pay for it. So he said the fairest way to pay for this is to reduce the tax cut of the 200,000 people who paid taxes on over $1 million, not to raise their taxes, to reduce their tax cut from an average of then $88,000 a year to $83,000. A horrible burden. I promise you that 95% of all the millionaires in America, without regard to their party, would have said, for God's sakes, do it. Take my $5,000 and make America safer. But it failed because the White House and the Republican leadership defeated it. Isn't that right? They would rather give me $5,000 more and protect 300 million Americans. Don't talk to me about Homeland Security. Now, then, just the other day, there was another proposal to spend $650 million a year to put in sensors in all our big ports, to at least do electronic sensor testing of all the cargo containers. It can be done for $650 million. The administration said we could not afford it because of the deficit. Go figure. A deficit that they made bigger because they said the drug program was going to cost $400 billion when it cost $550 billion. So, we can't afford this. And then they turned around and presented their number one priority, more than Homeland Security, to repeal the state tax for the less than 1% of the American people that are covered by it. You know what it costs? $250 billion over a decade. $25 billion a year. In other words, it was more than 25 times. Whatever you think about the estate tax, you just think about this. It was more than 25 times more important for them to give estate tax relief to less than 1% of us who already got more money we know what to do with than it was to provide Homeland Security for 300 million of us. That is ideology, not evidence. You need to stand against that, talk against it, and explain how we can do better than it.
There we go. With Bill Clinton, Monday night in Seattle, and it was a good one. Jude on the line. Hey, Jude in Seattle. Hey, what's up?
Boy, I was just blown away listening to Clinton. I took me on a
I just I'm doing a follow up on an article in the U.S. Time or in the U.S. Today on in July, and it talked about naturalization for soldiers that had served over in the war. And I ended up pulling up a piece, Tom. It's from a retired Army Brigadier General, Kevin Ryan, and he's at Harvard University, Kennedy School of Law. And he goes on about, he states that the U.S. Army is to open a recruiting station in Delhi, India, tapping into non-citizens eager to wear the U.S. uniform.
Yeah, we're already doing that in the United States. They're aggressively recruiting people who are illegal immigrants inside the United States and saying, if you want to have an opportunity to gain citizenship, join the Army and it'll be a fast track to citizenship. We've had a number of people gain their citizenship posthumously as a consequence of having died in Iraq while, you know, serving the United States, and they weren't even citizens.
Yeah, it just the article went on. It said that Bush had signed an executive order, one of, you know, probably the 700 or whatever, in 2002 that allowed about 35,000 to petition. And to date, there's been 26,000 that have been brought in. And, you know, they even just thanks, Tom, for everything that you do. There's so much information, you know.
There is, Jude. It seems, you know, there are some days where it seems like it gets grimmer and grimmer and grimmer. But I'll tell you the good news, Jude, is that people are waking up.
Awesome.
People are absolutely waking up. And thank you for the call. As, you know, Bill Clinton wrapped up his speech the other night, Monday night, he said, you know, these guys, they've run this old dog so long, it ain't going to hunt anymore. And I've really, you know, the only way they can win elections is by stealing them. And there's a limit to how much and how long they can do that before the people start standing up like they are in Mexico right now. Our Democrats need to be looking down to Mexico and learning a good lesson from it. On tomorrow's program, Bernie Sanders will be with us, and David Tebow and I are going to be talking about parental notice and abortion. That and more, your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And don't forget that activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.